The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, titled Development of Ashkenazic Liturgy and Custom, The Life and Times of the Maharil, is dedicated to the memory and Le'ilui Nishmas Chana Chaya Bas Mendel Aleha Shalom, a blessed memory, on the occasion of her Yortzeit, Chof Teves.
A story is told of King Frederick of Prussia, known as King Frederick the Great, who was a free thinker and a supporter of the Enlightenment. He once asked his royal chaplain, who was a Lutheran minister, to prove to him that God exists. The chaplain answered his king in two words, the Jews. The history of the Jews, according to the royal chaplain, was a compelling proof for God's existence far greater than the proofs offered by the philosophers through the ages. The Torah predicted over 3,000 years ago that the Jews will experience unabated and unspeakable suffering in their exile. That prediction has unfortunately been richly fulfilled. The Jewish historian Josephus Flavius, writing almost 2,000 years ago, stated that no nation from the beginning of time has suffered like the Jews. You can only imagine what he would write if he were alive today. And yet, all those present here tonight bear testimony to the miracle of Jewish survival. The fact that the ancient homeland of the Jews today contains about a third of world Jewry's population, free from the oppression of foreign governance, Shibud Malchus, and at Yerushalayim, Jerusalem, the ancient seat of Jewish learning, and Bnei Brak, the city where Rabbi Akiva once taught the future Torah leaders of Jewry, today resounds with the voices of tens of thousands of scholars studying Torah, is truly an amazing miracle. There's probably no place on earth during the Middle Ages that witnessed a similar miracle than the land of Germany. As we've pointed out in previous lectures, time and again, Germany became soaked with Jewish blood. First, of course, in 1096, for the well-established communities of Mainz, Worms, and Cologne in the Rhine Valley were almost totally decimated, together with many other communities in the Moselle Valley and those communities that were along the path of the Crusaders. The Jews of Germany, Ashkenaz, however, managed to rebuild their communities and went on to produce the giants that we discussed in previous lectures, Rabbi Eliezer of Metz, Raivan, Ravio, Rabbi Yehuda HaChosid, Rabbi Eliezer Rekeach, the Ozarua, the Maram of Wittenberg, the Rosh, the Mordechai, and countless other saints and scholars. That golden age of Germany came to a tragic end at the latter part of the 13th century. In the first half of the 14th century, witnessed death and destruction unparalleled in the annals of European history. Besides sporadic massacres, such as the destruction of the entire Jewish community of Frankfurt am Main in 1241, and the wholesale slaughter of the community of Munich in 1285, in the years 1298 and 1299, a mob of German rabble, led by a nobleman by the name of Rindfleisch, murdered more than 100,000 German and Austrian Jews and destroyed over 100 communities. Amongst the victims was Rav Mordechai ben Hillel, author of the Sefer Mordechai, Rav Meir ben Yukasil, author of the Hagos Maimonis. These were amongst the greatest of the disciples of Maram of Wittenberg. A short time later, the Rosh, Rav Asher ben Yechiel, together with his family, left Germany eventually to settle in Spain. With the exception of scholars such as Rav Yitzchak of Durin, author of the Shari Dura, the standard code of dietary laws for Ashkenazic Jewries in the Middle Ages, and Rav Chaim, the son of Rav Yitzchak ben Moshe, the author of the Ozarua, they were both disciples of the Maram of Wittenberg. Besides these two, there were few sages of stature left in Germany. with the Armaletter massacres in the two-year period from 1336 to 1337, which inflicted a terrible slaughter upon the Jews of Alsace and the Rhineland as far as Swabia in southwest Germany, and the ensuing charges of host desecrations, which we've discussed. This was the charge that the Jews had taken the wafer used in the Catholic Mass and desecrated it. Because of those charges in Deggendorf, Bavaria, and Pulka, Austria, which resulted in mass slaughter in Bavaria, Bohemia, Moravia, and Austria, Ashkenazic Jewry was only a shadow of itself. Yet even in those dark days, Hashem spread the lives of stages of such of stature, such as Alexander Zuslein HaKohen, a disciple of Yitzhak of Durin, who served as Rev in Cologne, Worms, and finally Frankfurt. His work, Aguda, a halachic compendium which cites rabbinical decisions that cover most of Talmudic law, was highly regarded and often quoted in subsequent generations. But despite all the German Jewry had experienced up to that time, it was only a preview of what was to become the ultimate German Holocaust, the Black Plague. In the aftermath of the plague which decimated Europe between the years 1348 and 1351, and made no distinction between Jews and Gentiles, blame was attributed to the Jews, who they claimed poisoned their wells, and this we discussed in the previous lecture. As a result, savage pogroms raged throughout Germany. In Erfurt, the city of his birth, where Alexander Zuslein HaKohen, the author of the Aguda, shared his fate with the rest of the 3,000 Jews of that city that were massacred. In the wake of these pogroms, there were virtually no Jews left in all of Germany or in the Low Countries. The only major exception to the wholesale slaughter being the cities of Regensburg and Vienna, who protected their Jews. And protected the Jews who survived the Black Plague. Miraculously, though, despite all these catastrophes, those relatively few who survived began to rebuild their communities. Eventually, over the next century, Germany once again became a major tourist center. Vienna, that was spared the pogroms in the aftermath of the Black Plague, became the center of this rebirth. The scholars of Vienna and its environs, such as Rav Meir ben Baruch Halevi, Rav Rom Klausner, Rav Shalom of Neustadt, taught and inspired a whole new generation of scholars, such as Rav Isaac of Turno and Rav Yaakov ben Moshe Molin, known as the Maharil. The generation that followed them, such as the Maharil's disciple Rav Yaakov Vail, Rav Yisrael Isserlein, the author of the Trumas Hadeshen, and Rav Yisrael Bruna, left an indelible mark on German Jewry and a rich halachic legacy. Much of Ashkenazic liturgy and practice is based upon their example in halachic decisions. Their story is the subject of tonight's lecture. And it would be helpful, at the end of your notes, we printed a timeline, so to speak, or a chronology here. And just briefly go over this because these names will be constantly quoted throughout the lecture. Of course, we begin just with Rav Meir ben Baruch of Rottenburg, this is the Maram of Rottenburg, and his famous disciples, and he died in the year 1293. His famous disciples were Osher ben Yechiel, the author of the Rosh, Rav Mordechai ben Hillel, which we mentioned, the author of the Mordechai, Rav Meir ben Yekusiel, the author of Hagos Maimonis, Rav Shimshon bar Tzadok. This is the he was the one who preserved much of the teachings of Maram Rutenberg. Rav Chaim or Zeruah, he was the son of Ben Rav Yitzchak of Vienna, the author of the Or Zeruah. Rav Yitzchak of Durin, Rav Moshe Parnas or Avram of Sinaheim. The next generation, there was clearly a lack after all these persecutions, was Alexander Zuslein HaKohen, which we call the author of the Aguda, who was a disciple of Yitzchak of Durin, who in turn was a disciple of Meir of Rottenburg. He died in the massacres that came in the period after the Black Plague in 1349. The next, the Gödel, the great leader during the subsequent period was Meir ben Baruch Halevi, which we're going to describe in great length. He died in Vienna around the year 1407. A colleague of his, Avram Klausner, who died in Vienna in 1408. And another colleague was Shalom of Neustadt, who died somewhere, when I clear, between the years 1413 and 1420. A disciple of theirs, Shalom Neustadt, was Aram Blumlein. He died in the massacres we're going to describe in Vienna in 1421. There's Isaac of Turnau, was a disciple of Rum Klausner, and he was the author of Sefer Minhogim, the Book of Customs. Rav Yaakov Molin, he's known as the Maharil, he died in Worms in 1427. He was a disciple of Shalom Neustadt, as well as a disciple of Meir ben Baruch Halevi and of Rum Klausner. Rav Yaakov Vail, who died in 1455, was a disciple of Yaakov Molin. Rav Yisrael Isserlein, who died in Neustadt in 1460. Neustadt was a suburb of a town outside of Vienna. He was a disciple of Aaron Blumlein, who was his uncle. And finally, Rav Yisrael Bruna, who died in Prague, was a disciple of both Rav Yaakov Vail and Rav Yisrael Isserlein. And again, he died in approximately the year 1480. To get an idea of what Ashkenazic Jewry looked like in the period following the Black Plague, I would like to first quote from the works of the Maharil and his disciple Rav Yaakov Vail, and finally from the Leket Yosher of Rav Yosef ben Moshe, the principal disciple of Yisrael Isserlein. Notice we just quoted them, you know, in the timeline. The author of the Sefer Aguda, and this is taken from a responsum from the Maharil, however, writes the following reason: why is it that the custom mentioned, the law, was mentioned in the Talmud, that a ritual slaughterer, a shochet, must show his knife first to the morad asra, to the rov of the city? Otherwise, he is not allowed to slaughter. And if he does so, he will be excommunicated. That law, which was in practice until the Middle Ages, eventually ceased to be in practice. And the question is, why not? I mean, if there's a law which is promulgated in the Talmud, it has, it stays in effect throughout all time. And this is how he explains this, the Maharil. And actually, this question was first addressed by the author of the Aguda, remember, Alexander Suslein HaKoyen. And he says, quote, "The Gaonim wrote..." The Gaonim over here, he means as preeminent Torah scholars, not the Gaonim in the period of the first millennium. Wrote that presently scholars do not demand that knife be used for slaughter to be shown them. Rather, they have absolved the ritual slaughterers from the responsibilities to show them the knife. In other words, he bases it first of all on the fact that it was done to honor, to show the honor and the position of the morad asra, of the chacham, of the scholar in the city. They're already meichel. They've already absolved the community of that, of this right of honor. But in addition, he writes, to that reason, it seems to me that due to our great sins, there are no scholars presently that are expert in even the tractate Kala. This is a reference to the Gemara in Shabbos in 114a. That's at the minimum definition of a scholar. In other words, we don't have the scholars that are mentioned in the Talmud do not exist today. This is what the author of the Aguda writes. Behold, now the Maharil is continuing on after he quoted the Aguda. Behold, that the master who authored the Sefer Aguda lived before the decree of the Black Plague in the year 1349. It is common knowledge that Gaonim, and again he's referring to men of great stature, lived in the land during that time. Now in this orphan generation, there is no one who knows the difference between their right and left hands. The fingernail of the earlier generations in their casual conversation were superior to the stomachs. This is a reference to Gemara and Yoma and Testament Base. To the inner essence and Torah knowledge of the later generations. Is there anyone in this generation that can test this fact? The principle elucidated in the Talmud, Yiftach and his generation, you know, is like Shmuel and his generation, which in this, one has to follow the rulings of the Torah scholar in your generation, and we don't make a judgment as to the level of scholarship of the one who's making the decision. It does not apply. That statement is referring to matters of judgment and the responsibility of accepting a current judge's legal decision, as we derive from the verse, and unto the judge of those days. Not to the honor to which he may be entitled. That honor is really based to someone who knows the entire Torah. And that was the level of scholarship he felt was up until this day, and that there was a precipitous drop after the Black Plague. According to the Agud, even before that. And probably, we won't say, from the time of Maram, you know, from the Rinfleish massacres at the end of the 1200s. And we continue on here on page 2, and this is a tshuva for Rav Yaakov Vail, who was a disciple of the Maharil, of Rav Yaakov Molin. The one who composed Sefer Aguda lived before the decree of 1349 and was an extraordinary savant. He himself wrote that in his time already the special laws regarding scholars were no longer in force. Most certainly this is so in our time, when due to our great sins, the hearts, I mean, the ability to understand has become diminished, and there are many rabbis who do not even know the basics of the Talmud. They possess neither bread nor clothing, figuratively referring to Torah knowledge. Their house is lacking anything of substance. There are those amongst them that arrogantly attempt to lord over others and misuse the crown of the rabbinate. Their intention in studying Torah is in order to enhance their own honor, so they will be able to sit in the front of the assembly or walk at the head of the community. There are those amongst them whose motivation is the accumulation of wealth. They do not have any of the special character traits that the sages enumerated regarding the proper conduct of a scholar. Their sole intention is their own pleasure. There are those amongst them that are not careful with their actions, have a bad reputation, and through them the name of heaven is desecrated. It is obvious they did not have the legal status of a scholar, neither regarding the right of a scholar to take the law into his own hands, if he cannot wait to go to a court, which was a special privilege of a true scholar, nor regarding the right of a scholar to fine a person a litra of gold if he acts disrespectfully towards him. For this reason, we do not afford any savant the privileges of a scholar. This is the fulfillment of the proverb, together with the thorn, the cabbage is smitten. I mean, the good, the true scholars are punished with the bad. In other words, there are people of integrity, there are people of real scholarship. Unfortunately, felt that they are a minority, and therefore the custom as a whole to give to scholars certain privileges have been taken away. But again, we have a historic sense, and again, one could very often, maybe these statements are said, you know, because of frustrations and hyperbola, but it gives you a sense of their understanding how the generations had dropped. And that really is the important thing here. But finally, to put this all in perspective, I quote here from the Leket Yosher. This is from a disciple of the Rav Yisrael Isserlein. You know, if you notice in your in the thing, he was the Gadol, and he was a Neustadt, and he passed away in the year 1460. He writes, Rav Yisrael Isserlein said that he heard from Rav Sholem of Neustadt, of blessed memory, that the reason why Torah was perpetuated in Germany more than any other lands was because they take interest on loans made to the Gentiles, and they don't have to do manual labor. Because of this, they have free time to study Torah. He who doesn't actually study helps those that do from the profit of the loan business. He also said that the reason the Gentiles are attempting to stop the practice of loaning on interest is because those who are making profit through this venture are not supporting those who are studying Torah. It is a miracle within a miracle that the Gentiles, by and large, are willing to allow the Jews to take interest. It is certainly providential. Now, however, the attribute of judgment is demanding punishment, and the sin of not supporting the study of Torah is included in the curse of, quote, he who does not uphold the Torah. The verse is referring to those who do not support the students of Torah, either by giving them merchandise on consignment or outright gifts. But we see, on the other hand, the Torah, even though that perhaps the level of Torah scholarship had dropped, the love of Torah had generally not. And Jews, by and large, were studying Torah and supporting Torah, even though, again, there's a critique that the level again had a certain sense diminished. Because of the condition of Torah scholarship that existed at that time, it is only natural that one of the priorities of the rabbis was to set standards for communal rabbis, so that only the most competent would be allowed to take a position of leadership. It was this in mind that the leading rabbis of Ashkenazic Jewry issued an order that no Talmudic scholar could officiate as a rabbi unless he received smicha, ordination, and had the title Morenu conferred upon him. This practice has been basically followed by Ashkenazic Jewry to this very day. One of the rabbis most associated with that edict was Rav Meir ben Boruch Halevi. Again, you can always keep referring to the timeline. One of the principal rabbis of Vienna. He should not be confused with Rav Meir ben Boruch, who was a Marad of Rutenberg, in other words, but he was a Levi, versus the other one's not. Rav Meir wished to introduce this system into France. And we're going to see, even though in a certain sense this system had existed already, and ordained the French scholar of Yeshaya ben Abba Mori as chief rabbi of France and granted him the sole authority to ordain other rabbis without within France's domain. There was a severe problem here, however. There was at the time, however, another great scholar in France, perhaps younger than Rav Yeshaya. This is Rav Yochanan Trevis. His father, Rav Matizio Trevis, the chief rabbi of Paris, had been appointed to that post by King Charles V of France in the year 1363, and he served in that capacity until his death in the year 1387. In his early years, Rav Matizio had been a disciple of the great Sephardic scholars Rabbeinu Nissim ben Ruvain, known as the Ran, and Rav Peretz HaKoyen. Rav Matizio's colleague was the great Sephardic scholar Rav Yitzchak ben Sheshes, known as the Rivosh. Approximately the year 1387, Rav Matizio was succeeded by his son and disciple, Rav Yochanan, and was confirmed in that position by the community as well as King Charles VI of France. Understandably, when Rav Meir ben Boruch Halevi appointed a disciple of his, who had originally been a disciple of Rav Matizio's, this was Rav Yeshaya's Yishtorek ben Abba Mori, and he appointed him to be the sole authority of France, there was great confusion and agitation within the Jewish community. Here is a quote from Yitzchak ben Sheshes, the Rivosh's ruling on the subject. This is on page 4. That's very, very interesting. He thinks politics is just in Detroit, huh? The above-mentioned Rav Matizio prepared his heart to study and teach the statutes and judgments of the Torah in that land of France. He set up yeshivas and spread the Torah in public and increased his boundaries with disciples. Those who came before him as young men became mature scholars who were engaged in the rhetoric of the Talmud in the West and the North and defeating formidable adversaries. In other words, this is really referring to the give and take and the argumentation and finding the truth in Talmudic study. Many rabbis who now had yeshivas or his graduates, for his leaned his hand upon them, in other words, gave them smicha, and his splendor has emanated upon them. There are many other scholars who listened intently to his words and who dwell in the depths of halacha, even though they have no official position. Through the merits of the compassionate one and his merit and through the help of the merit of his forefathers, he found grace in the eyes of the king. Through his love of him, all of the Jews who dwelled in land were secure together with him. He was for them a wall and a shield. Because all of the communities of the kingdom recognized the goodness of his actions, the righteousness of his deeds, the combination of his greatness in Torah and outstanding material wealth, and they enjoyed peace and quiet in that land only because of him, they accepted him to be their prince, judge, rabbi, and litigator, did they not rebel against his dictates and do all that he expressed regarding litigation between one man and another. His rulings in matters of Torah law and all of their actions would be formulated according to his decisions. Even the king made him their lord and rule in matters of their judgments. During his entire lifetime, he conducted his rabbinate rulership and leadership in an elevated manner in that kingdom. No one moved his hand or opened his mouth or uttered a sound. Afterwards, due to the sin of the generation, there was a great punishment, and the aforementioned Rabbatazion was sought after to become a member of the divine assembly. And as poetically said, he passed away. May his soul be bound up in the bond of life. The communities of that kingdom, upon seeing that their leader and captain was taken from them, looked for help in their difficulty and appointed in his stead his son, Rabbi Yochanan, may the Lord protect him. This is because they viewed him as the proper successor of his father in Torah knowledge and fear of sin. In addition, his father ordained him while he was still alive with the degree Yorah Yorah Yodin Yodin, and gave him permission to establish his own separate yeshiva. I mean, that is the standard nusaf, in other words, of smicha. Yorah Yorah is conferring ordination in matters of iser v'heter, in other words, ritual law of kashrus, and Yodin Yodin is in matters of litigation. This he did. He left his father and went to a different city and set up a yeshiva for many years while his father was still alive. From the time Rabbi Matisyahu died until the present, a period of 5 years, so this would be an indication that this shuva was written, this responsum was written in the year 1392. Rabbi Yochanan has followed the path of his father, may he rest in peace in Eden. He is immersed in the study of Torah, rules upon matters of Torah law, and adjudicates disputes for the entire kingdom of France. He does it with the sanction of the king and the communities who accepted him as their authority. There was no one who expressed any criticism. He also spread the study of Torah, had many disciples. Three of his disciples are rabbis and authorities of Torah, whom he ordained in accordance with the custom of France and Germany, where rabbis ordain their disciples as rabbis when they see that they have reached a level of competence to rule over questions of Torah law, and give them the right to set up a yeshiva anywhere that they choose and to adjudicate and rule. Evidently, again, this the smicha predated, this is Baruch, this is Meir ben Baruch. I mean, it's hard to know exactly when this began. It's quite possible it began as after the death of Moran Rutenberg and the decline of the level of competence. But we don't have any hard and fast dates. But it seems already it was in place. Recently, a lion arose from his thicket. The lion of Be'eloi, this is again taken from poetically from a passage in the Gemara in Chulin. The tiger, the lion amongst a group of scholars, the one who pursues the war up until the gates. And evidently, he, Rivosh, writing about Yeshaya, maintained that he was a competent scholar. This is Rabbi Yeshaya, may the Lord protect him. Because of a disagreement that existed between himself and Rabbi Yochanan, may the Lord protect him, he left this place and went to Germany, to the great eagle with giant wings who is full of Torah and possesses the wisdom, and referred to Rabbi Meir Halevi. May the Lord protect him. Anger issued forth from him, and with a decree of excommunication, declared that Rabbi Yeshaya's domain would be all of France, and that the divorces and the chalitzas, if a man died leaving the wife a widow, and there are no children, the brother really has a claim to the wife, and it has to be the relationship has to end through the performance of a chalitza. So divorces and chalitzas of any rabbi who would establish a yeshiva in France without Rabbi Yeshaya's approval would be considered invalid, and his vessels were to be considered the vessels of a non-Jew. The land of France quaked and roared in response to the decree that was issued. It was akin to a divine fear. Trembling took hold of them there, and pangs like giving birth. How could such a thing issue forth from Moram Halevi, who went and took over such a position of leadership, made a decree over a land that was not his? Even though he is extraordinary in both wisdom and in age, he still has no right to issue a decree for the kingdom of France without the authority of the communities of the kingdom or the authority of the scholars and rabbis of that kingdom. Even if Maram HaLevi felt that he personally has the strength and ability, power and lordship to make a binding decree upon all of the scattered of the exile, how could he give up such power to be a shy over the kingdom of France? After all, he also dwells outside of that kingdom. And as Rabbi Yeshaya never returned back to France. And the students that he that have achieved the competence of ruling upon issues of Torah law would have to make the great effort of traveling to a far-off land, to another kingdom, to receive authorization from him. Most certainly his authority is questionable in the light of the fact that there exists in the kingdom of France scholars and rabbis, especially Rabbi Yochanan, who inherited from his father Rabbi Matisyo, may he rest in peace, in Aden, the position of leadership with the approval of the king and the will of those communities. In addition, Rabbi Yochanan is fit for the position by virtue of his expertise in Torah and his experience. And quoting from a Gemara in Brachas in 28a in Chavches Amad Aleph, the one who is used to wearing the proper clothing of leadership should continue to do so. For such a thing, one should certainly cry bitterly. They should cry out in the streets, and the ends of the earth should hear their voices. They ask those that know the paths of the world and those that know the law and judgment for all that is hidden. They sought the Torah from their mouths and asked. And these are the other scholars of France. Went to seek, how do we get out of this situation here? Are the communities of France as a whole and as individuals required to heed the decree of Maram HaLevi and to follow his dictates? Or are they absolutely not required because Maram HaLevi has no power over them to issue such a decree? In addition, this decree is unbecoming of him. How can he remove from office for no crime? Rabbi Yochanan, a man who has acted in that capacity by virtue of the authority of the king and the will and authority of the communities. In addition, there is a certain cessation of Torah study involved, as the students who reach the level to be able to rule on matters of Torah law have already set up yeshivas in their respective areas, and yeshivas have multiplied, and the whole land is full of Torah knowledge and intelligence, and all of the children were learning Hashem's Torah. If they will henceforth need to travel to the ends of the earth and receive authorization from Yeshaya, all of this will just peter out. Amongst the scholars that were asked regarding this matter, I was also called upon. This is the Rivosh's writing. Even though I am not worthy of being part of this group of scholars, and I am afraid to place my head amongst the two great mountains, between two great controversies, lest they crush my skull. This is a reference to the Gemara Yevamos in 15b. However, in order to appease an old friend, Rabbi Yehuda Rabbi Eliezer, who has traveled from afar, says, regarding this issue, I cannot leave him empty-handed. In addition, I see that my silence is in a small measure a desecration of the divine name, as this matter only adds to the accusations between scholars, and the fire of contentions is burning them up. There's no one putting out the flames. For such a thing, a man of diminished stature like myself, who comes to extinguish the fire, is listened to, and they don't dismiss him. Therefore, I will state that which seems right in my eyes, and will only show favoritism to the truth, which is our greatest love. Just to summarize how he continues to write, this is in a further response. This is on number 2 on the bottom, page 6. He says, we are shocked at Maram HaLevi for having made a decree for a land that was beyond his jurisdiction. How could such a thing be done? Why, we haven't even tried to make any decrees in this land of Spain or any legislation or decision. Rather, every separate community with authority of the king makes their own legislation and enforces its own rulings. It seems that Rivosh's opinion was not the last word on the subject. Unfortunately, the controversy still raged on. What Rav Meir's position was on this matter, and why he appointed Rav Yeshayahu over Rav Yochanan, is not clear. However, in terms of the jurisdiction to make appointments and issue ruling beyond one's territory, the following responsum of the Trumas Hadeshin of Rav Yisrael Isserlein is very instructive. It makes this issue, says, all the more difficult to understand. Now we quote on page 7. Again, this is an amazing response of Tshuva from Yisrael Isserlein. He was asked, this is many years later, to issue an excommunication on a community beyond his. And he writes the following. I have seen the decision of the extraordinary elder scholar of Meir Siegel, this is Sagan Levia. The word Segel means Sagan is like the vice president. Well, next in line, Levia is the Levi. In other words, he's the one who helps the Kohen. And that's the title used. So any Siegels are Levium. Who originated from the land of the Rhine Valley, and later on he moved to Vienna. And who knew the entire source material of its laws and customs. It was confirmed by the great rabbi Avrom Klausner of Vienna and Rapesach of Krems. It is evident to me that the signatures on the document are valid, especially Rapesach's whose signature is rare, and I clearly know that it was his signature. The above-mentioned elder scholar, again referring to Rav Meir, this is Rav Meir bar Baruch Halevi, issued the decision and wrote that he had heard and received from the earlier generations of scholars that one cannot force the lower region of the Rhine Valley, which is north of Koblenz, to abide by their rulings, as there are always people of distinction and cadres of scholars and men of integrity who hate ill-begotten gain, were common amongst them. In any case, since the lower region had a Beis Din, a Jewish court of law, not even the communities or courts of Speyer, Worms, and Mainz had the power to force them to come before them to be judged. This is the tshuva that he wrote. It would seem from the words of that elder scholar that they couldn't even protest or display their displeasure, even though it's understood the communities of Speyer, Worms, and Mainz were much greater scholars. Most certainly now in our time. Now this he's continuing on. This is Israel, where the lower region has an expert based in a cadre of scholars, where they only increase. One cannot impose their wills upon them. And he continues on, I maintain that anyone who violates this decision is breaching a fence, is undermining the boundary which the early generations have demarcated. One should not listen to such a person at all, whether it be an individual or decrees or punishes, or whether a group agrees to that action. No punishment or excommunication or decree or imposed stringency is valid. They have absolutely no basis upon which to act, and the one who makes such a decree or punishes is included in the category of who illegally imposes excommunication. If I had not found the basis of all of this, the writings of those who formed the foundation of the earth, the gonim of the generation, I wouldn't have had the courage to construct or deconstruct arguments concerning this subject. Now I have the precedent of the early generation, I surely refrain from writing a writ of excommunication or making a decree even for an adjacent area, and most certainly for a distant place. The precedent of not issuing a writ of excommunication beyond one's area of jurisdiction is the Maram Salevi. The Trumas HaDeshen is basing this principle on the decision of Rav Meir ben Baruch Halevi, that one is not allowed to issue any writ of excommunication in an area beyond one's control. Oh, that's the kasha. Oh, that's the question. How could, in the light of this ruling that he himself had made, Rav Meir ben Baruch, how could he go back now and issue a ruling regarding all of France? By the way, this controversy in France only lasted a few years, as all the Jews were expelled from France in the year 1394. One wonders if this machlokes, this controversy, was a contributing factor. Jews did not come back to France for hundreds of years afterwards. There's only in a few small communities in Provence that were under the Pope that Jews were still allowed. But France as a whole, actually there were no Jews. Rabbi Yochanan relocated to Italy, where he continued to teach and be Maimed Talmidim and produce disciples until his death in the year 1439. According to historians, Rav Yochanan's disciples became leading Torah scholars in Italy, and some became mentors of the Maharik, Rav Yosef Kolon, one of the leading rabbinic scholars of the 15th century. In retrospect, it is difficult to understand the reason why Rav Meir ben Baruch Halevi appointed Rav Shayot over all of France. After all, the principle that one does not have the right to issue edicts or make appointments outside one's own territory was a principle to which Rav Meir himself subscribed, as we read in paragraph C. Perhaps the reason he appointed Rav Shayot was that he was under the impression of Yochanan was unfit for the position. There was no one of stature in all of France. All the information that is available to us, however, seems to contradict this, that Rav Yochanan was a prestigious scholar. Besides the information we know from the response that were sent to and from the Rivosh regarding this matter, that France was a place of Torah. So Rav Matas Yo had himself given ordination to 8 Rabbonim who were active in their respective communities. And both Rav Matas Yo and Rav Yochanan were held in the highest regard by the Rivosh. but I would like to quote here from the great scholar and disciple of Rav Meir ben Baruch, Rav Yaakov Halevi, the Maharil, in a response regarding Rav Yochanan and Trevis. And here he says on page 8, he just describes him, Alufenu, Morenu, Moifes, Derenu, our leader, guide, and wonder of the generation, Rav Yochanan, may the Lord protect him. Perhaps the true answer is, as Rav Yochanan himself stated in his letter to the Rivosh, that Rav Meir was misinformed. Rav Meir never went to France and relied upon information supplied to him by others. And therefore he felt that France was a place that was really not a place of Torah at all, and in a certain sense then fell under the jurisdiction of Germany. Rav Meir ben Baruch Halevi left a profound mark on his generation and those who came after him. In the era where it was important to reestablish the honor of Torah and Torah scholarship, Rav Meir served as a shining example as to what a Rav should be. If the following remark of his is any indication, it would seem that he avoided the honors that would normally do a man of such stature. And this is on page 8. I really quoted this, I believe, when I gave the lecture on the life of Rav Yehuda HaNasi, Rav Yehuda Prince, the editor of the Mishnah. It was taught, Rav Yehuda HaNasi honored the wealthy. This is Rebbe Mechabed Ashirim. Maharil says that he heard from Aram Segal, as this was the Maram, this is Meir ben Baruch, that the explanation of that passage is that Rebbe himself was exceptionally wealthy. He therefore was in the habit of honoring the wealthy so that the people would learn from him, they would also honor him because of his wealth, not because of his Torah knowledge. This is because he did not want to use the crown of the Torah to enhance his stature. Similarly do we find regarding Rabbi Akiva. And it's quite likely if he was the one who offered this, he was himself a person, you know, who shunned honors. Also, here on page 9, I heard directly from Yonah ben Reb Sholem the elder, my relative. This is written by the Trumas Hadeshin, who said in the name of his father, this is Reb Sholem of Neustadt, I and my father sat in the yeshiva of Neustadt to judge and rule on matters of Torah law. If another would come to my place to take a position of leadership, and somebody down the block would open up a yeshiva, I would not hold him back. It is amazing. Where do leaders find a basis to claim that such a thing is an infringement of their territorial rights? When I told this over to Rav Anshel of Rafork, he told me that Rav Meir Segal said the following, who gave or bequeathed me a territory that cannot be infringed upon by another person? This is no hasogas gavul. There's no infringement of territorial rights when it comes to teaching. And he continued on, the sages forbade entering into a competition infringing upon another's territorial rights and required a person to distance himself from harming another only in a situation where the other person's livelihood was at stake, where his profits would be lessened and his source of income would be diminished. In this case, however, where one person desires to be involved in the leadership of the community and the other person wants to do so as well, and there's no resulting loss of revenue, who says it's forbidden in such an instance? Each one wants to merit the reward given to the caretakers of Israel, which is a reward without limit. Again, the source is this Maram Halevi. Maram Halevi of Blessed Avram Klozner. This was a tshuva again from a real vial dealing with the issue that another rabbi is allowed to move in and to set up a yeshiva. And he quotes, you know, various precedents for this. But again, the first president is Maram Halevi. Although Rav Meir Bar Baruch Halevi himself did not leave over anything in writing, he was often quoted by his disciples, and his effect was felt for generations to come. As we pointed out before, Rav Meir's greatest legacy was his involvement in correcting the ill effects of the decline of Torah scholarship, brought about by over 50 years of mass destruction. It was with that in mind that he was active in demanding smicha, ordination, and scholarly standards for Ashkenazic rabbinic leaders, which we discussed before. There was another problem that arose during that time that needed to be addressed. Because of the massive destruction, disruptions, and migrations, the customs and halachic traditions that have been preserved for generations in the various communities throughout Germany were now being lost. That sense of community and tradition, a major source of spiritual strength for German Jewry up to this very day, was at risk of being destroyed. In the words of Yitzhak Isaac Tirna, a disciple of the great scholars of Vienna during this period, and probably the first major Talmud Chacham who recited in Hungary. Here we quote him on page 10. The number of savants and scholars has diminished due to our many sins, and the ranks of people of integrity, Torah, and good deeds in Austria have become decimated to such an extent that I have found communities that don't even have two or three people who clearly know the true customs of their own city, and most certainly there are few people who know the customs outside of their city. Because of this, I, Isaac of Turnau, the inferior, not Sawyer, the novice, who from my youth was raised amongst such scholars as the Maharash, as Rav Sholem of Neustadt, Maharak, Ravram Klausner, Mahara, Rav Aaron Blumlein, the martyr, may Hashem avenge his blood, who are the essential residents of Austria and experts and knowledgeable in their authentic customs. It is their waters which we drink. I took upon myself to write this work. I've seen many old customs which in turn have many disparate customs, and as they, you know, within the customs there's offshoots. The great researcher Ravram Klausner of blessed memory, my most influential master, made many glosses. There was an existing, we're going to say, existing work on customs that he made glosses to, and brought many proofs and rationales which were not very necessary. Because of his greatness and expertise, he quoted many different opinions. In one gloss we found this opinion, in the second we find an opposing view. There's no way to know how to act. Therefore, I arranged and collected from those who had already made collections and only wrote down the conclusive custom. Heaven can only testify that I did not do this for my personal honor, but rather only to fulfill the needs of humanity, so that the reader can quickly run through the material that is extremely necessary at this moment. To fully understand the importance of the work to reestablish the correct minhag, custom and tradition, I'd like to spend a little bit of time tracing the role of minhagim in halacha in Jewish law. And here on page 10, we know that the binding nature of rabbinic law, according to the Rambam, custom, which was instituted by the high court, is equally binding. And one really is in violation of Torah law if one violates a custom that was instituted at the behest of the Sanhedrin. And here on the bottom of page 10, one must abide by the ruling of the Sanhedrin, whether it is something which they taught based upon the oral tradition, this is the Torah Shebaal Peh, they had actual tradition, whether it be something which they derived on their own based upon the 13 hermeneutical rules of interpretation, in other words, this is the Yud Gimel Midas, or whether it be rules which they made on their own to protect the Torah according to the needs of the hour. These are the decrees, this is negative legislation like muktzah, moving things that are of no use on Shabbos. Legislation, these are takon, is a positive, lighting Hanukkah licht, those lights on Hanukkah, and customs. There is a positive commandment to listen to them in regard to any one of these three things. One who violates any one of these things is in violation of a negative commandment. Behold, it says, according to the law which they guide you, this refers to legislation, decrees, and customs which they guide thereby the multitude in order to strengthen the law and correct the shortcomings of the world. One of those customs, according to the Rambam, for instance, is outside of Israel to keep the second day Yom Tov. That's a custom which was created at the behest of the Sanhedrin. And it continues on in the second, this is in Hilchos Mamrim, this is in the first chapter, and the second chapter continues on, when the court sees the need to issue a decree or enact legislation or institute a custom, they need to carefully consider it and to know beforehand if the majority of the community will be able to abide by it or not. We never issue a decree upon the community if the majority of the community will not be able to abide by it. So we deal with custom in the same way we deal with rabbinic legislation. The custom is not only the custom which is universal, like the second day, you know, outside of Israel keeping the second day Yom Tov. We find here in paragraph B of a custom of a place. Whereas the custom to do work on the eve of Passover until midday is after midday, one is not allowed by rabbinic legislation to do work. But before that, there are differences of custom. Whereas the custom to do work, one may do work. Whereas the custom not to do work, one may not do work. He goes from a place where they work to a place where they do not work, or from a place where they do not work to a place where they do work. We put upon the restrictions of the place from whence he departed and the restriction of the place where he is gone. The man must not act differently from a local custom on account of the quarrels which may ensue. Even though this is not your place, you're only a visitor, you're going to go back home, you're still required to act within the dictates of local custom. And this is a Mishnah Psachim in Daf Nun, in 50a and B. And in 50b, the Gemara, the Talmud continues, the citizens of Bashan were accustomed not to go from Tyre to Sidon on the eve of Shabbos. The Sidon, Sidon, which is a port city on Lebanon, just directly north of Tyre, of Tsor, had a market day on Friday. And the citizen of Bashan, who lived not far from there, did not go to the market day. It was too close to Shabbos. Their children went to Rabbi Yochanan and said to him, "For our fathers this was possible. They had the wherewithal. For us it is impossible. We can't make a living, you know, or at least a good living, unless we participate in this market." Said he to them, "Your fathers have already taken upon themselves for it. As it is said, 'Hear, my son, the instructions of thy father. Forsake not the teachings of thy mother.'" This is taken from Proverbs, and the father refers to Torah, and this is a proverb. And the mother refers to the customs that are instituted. Your mother means the Jewish people. Customs are binding. To the extent that a custom has power, and which we're going to discuss again, this is taken from a Gemara Menachos in 32a, this is in paragraph C on the bottom, page 11. Rabbah said in the name of Kahana, who said from Rab, "If Eliyahu Anavi," Eliyahu probably were to come and say that chalitza may be performed with a covered shoe, with a regular shoe, he would be obeyed. Were, however, to say that chalitza may not be performed with a sandal, he would not be obeyed, even though he would say that he comes and testifies there's already previous rabbinic legislation for whatever reason, that one cannot use a sandal, he would not be obeyed. For the people have long ago adopted the practice of performing it with a sandal. Because the custom has really the right as precedence over rabbinic law. And as we quote from the Yerushalmi here on top of page 12, this is Rabbi Bob, or Yehuda said the name of Rav, if Elior would come and say that chalitza may be performed with a covered shoe, he would be obeyed. Were, however, to say chalitza may not be performed with a sandal, would not be obeyed, for the multitude has adopted the practice of performing it with a sandal, and a custify nullifies a law. Minig mevatlis ahalocha. This is the power of custom. We're going to say what kind of a custom. It has to be a custom instituted by the legal, you know, scholars, authorities. But there is the power of custom. Custom has the right to really to rule on matters of halacha. As we have on paragraph D on page 12, it discusses various issues where there's an argument, and custom has favored the minority view. And we rule with that minority view. It gives three examples. Nachman used to say it has become the custom to follow these three elders. Rabbi Eloi in the matters of the first shearing. There's a question of racious hagez, of the first shearing, which is supposed to be given to the Kohen. Does it apply outside of Israel or not? The custom has it that we do follow the rule of Rabbi Eloi that it does not apply outside of Israel. So someone who is a sheep farmer and the does shearings, he does not have to give a portion to the Kohen. Rabbi Yoshi, a matter of mixed kinds, we said the laws of Kilai Kerem, that mixed kinds in a vineyard only apply when they are planted together. Two mixed kinds, let's say wheat and barley, together with a seed of grape seed, would be planted together. Again, this is a singular opinion, Rabbi Yoshi's opinion, but we rely upon this. This is even a matter of Torah law, because that is the custom. He says that it only applies in that situation. It does not apply as you'd normally think. There's an existing vineyard, and you're planting, you know, seeds in an existing vineyard. you're not allowed to plant in Israel mixed seeds in any case, but there's a special prohibition of planting it in a vineyard, and the result is that the grapes are forbidden, and the wheat, whatever comes out is forbidden in pleasure. According to Rav Yosef, this law only applies when they are planted together. You have the grape seed and two other varieties. And Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseir, in the matters of words of Torah, there was a Ezra, one of the takonas of Ezra, is that one has marital relations, one has to go to the mikveh before one studies Torah, one davens. There was a whole question if it applies, or to the extent that it applies, subsequently. Did it take hold? Was it, according to Tosfos, is a possibility that it may have been... that another court may have overruled it. Whatever it was, the majority opinion was that it is in effect. Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseir is a minority that it is not in effect. But we follow Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseir's ruling that one does not have to go to the mikveh, says, because it is the custom. Again, this is the power of custom. Again, the custom we're going to speak is not like eating blintzes on Shavuos or what other different foods, kreplach on before Yom Kippur and Hoshana Rabbah. We're dealing with customs of halacha. And it continues on, there's about the role of custom here. There's Yerushalmi and Peah. This is in Perek Zion, Halacha Hey. Reb Oven said in the name of Yeshua ben Levi, not only regarding this particular law, but rather in any case where the Beis Din is unsure and you don't know the correct practice, go out and see what the community is doing and accustom yourself accordingly. Now this custom has the power of what the Halacha is. I would just like, again, just in... this inclusion, you could look at the other quotes, but inclusion in this section on page 13, the bottom, we have a tshuva from the Ramah, who's a subject of a coming lecture here. Again, about the role of custom. Marik has already written in his responsa that if a custom is found in the work of any authority, we view it to be authoritative, and one cannot invalidate it. Similarly, the Talmud states, the citizens of Bashan were accustomed not to go from Tyre to Sidon on the eve of Sabbath. Their children went to Rabbi Yochanan and said to him, for our fathers this was possible, for us it was impossible. Said he to them, your fathers already taken upon themselves. As it is said, hear my son, the instruction of thy father, and forsake not the teachings of thy mother. From here we can derive that even in times of difficulty, one is not allowed to change one's custom. In addition, Marik also writes, behold, a custom was instituted for the honor of the Torah, even pushes aside a rabbinic prohibition, i.e. dancing on Yom Tov. Actually, there's a disagreement. According to Talmudic law, so Mishnah, one is not allowed to dance on Shabbos or Yom Tov. There is a question if it applies even in our days. Hasidim are more lenient. The non-Hasidim are more machmer. Don't refrain from clapping hands or dancing on Shabbos or Yom Tov. However, in Simchas Torah, the custom is one does dance. And this is the idea of custom took precedence over rabbinic law. Further on, he states, even though there's really a whole discussion to the extent where custom has the power to rule, you know, in matters of law, and when it goes against, you know, rabbinic opinion, that goes beyond the scope of this lecture. Further on, he states, even against the normative halacha do we follow the custom as long as it was established by the scholars of the place. Even if the custom may involve some prohibition, one should not invalidate it. The proof is from the chapter of Kometz Rabbah, as we quoted before, Menachos 32a. Rabbah said, the name of Kahanu said, had it from Rab, if Eliyahu were to come and say the chalitza may be performed with a covered shoe, he would be obeyed. Were however to say the chalitza may not be performed with a sandal, he would not be obeyed. For the people have long ago adopted the practice of performing it with a sandal. He goes on in great length to prove that even a custom was established in only one place should not be invalidated because of halacha considerations. As we stated before, Vienna at that time was the leading Torah center of Europe. One of its great scholars, Avram Klausner, edited a work written or previously edited by a scholar who was a contemporary of the Maram Rutenberg. His name was Reb Chaim Paltiel of Magdeburg in Saxony. It is a very interesting yet difficult work to read. It's full of various glosses. It is very difficult to directly deduce from the work what the proper practice should be. It was this work that Rav Isaac of Tirnow, Rav Ram Klausner's disciple, referred to previously. And it was with those difficulties in mind that he created his own improved Sefer HaMenhagim, Book of Customs, which is widely quoted by later authorities, the Sefer HaMenhagim. Another one of the great luminaries of Vienna was the Sholem of Neustadt. Except for a relatively small remnant of his responsa, nothing remains from his own personal writings. His customs and legal decisions, however, were collected by one of his disciples, Rav Yospa Ostreicher. Ostreicher means from Austria. One of Rav Sholem's closest disciples, who eventually became one of his colleagues in the rabbinate of Vienna, was Rav Aaron Blumlein, an uncle of Rav Yisrael Isserlein. From the archives of the city of Vienna, we know Rav Ram Klausner was nifter, passed away in the year 1408. The archives also recall that his older colleague, Rav Meir Halevi, was still alive in the year 1406. We can assume, however, that he probably passed away not long after. In the year 1413, Rav Sholem was nifter, passed away. We know he was alive at that time, and we know he passed away in that year, a few years afterwards. He left over not only disciples, but his two sons, Torah giants in their own right, who led the communities of Vienna and its suburb, Vienna Neustadt. This golden age of Austrian Jewry came to a terrible end in the year 1420. A confluence of several events came together with disastrous results. The Hussites, followers of John Huss, a heretical Bohemian cleric who was condemned to death by the church, began to openly rebel against the government of Emperor Sigismund and the Catholic Church. Accused of aiding and abetting the heresy, the Jews were singled out by the Dominicans as being its major cause. Of course, it's always the Jews. In addition, after three Christian children were found missing, they actually fell through the ice and drowned after going skating, a rumor was spread that the Jews had killed them as part of their Passover ritual. And finally, a Jew by the name of Yisrael was said to have bought the host, in other words, the sacred wafer, used, in the Catholic Mass, from the wife of the sacristan, in other words, the shamash, the church attendant, of the city of Enns. Rav Yisrael was then charged with dividing it up and sending it throughout the Jewish communities of Austria, ostensibly to desecrate it, as Jews were commonly accused, like Jews have nothing better to do. After torture, you can imagine what they did. Rav Yisrael and his wife confessed to this absurd crime. On the 23rd of May, the 10th of Sivan, 1420, Archduke Albert issued an order to imprison all of the Jews in his realm. Wives were separated from their husband and children from their parents in order to make them more amenable to their efforts to convert them and accept the great mercy of the church. I quote here, this is on the bottom of page 14, from the account from Trumas Hadeshim Yisrael Isserlein of what occurred. Some of them who were kept in captivity followed the path of the Jews of Worms, Mainz, and Cologne during the First Crusade and committed mass suicide. According to an account of the incident known as the Wiener Gzera, the Viennese Decree, on the holiday of Sukkot, Rabbi Yonah, in all probability the son of Sholem of Neustadt and a leading rabbi in Vienna, slaughtered all of those who were together with him in prison and then himself committed suicide. Finally, after almost a year of confinement, on the 9th of Nisan, on the 13th of March, those who did not already convert, there were people who did convert, or kill themselves, were committed to the flames. In Vienna alone, more than 100 perished in one field alone, as they were brought there to be slaughtered. Afterwards, the Archduke Albert issued another order forbidding Jews to stay thenceforth in Austria. As described in the Truma Sedition that we quoted, at the first opportunity, most of the converts emigrated and returned back to Judaism. The mantle of leadership of all of Ashkenazic Jewry now fell upon the shoulders of the chief rabbi of Mainz and leading rabbi of all of Western Germany, Rav Yaakov ben Moshe Molin Halevi, a leading disciple of the outstanding rabbis of Austria. He was widely known as the Maharil, Moreno Harav Yaakov Halevi. The title Moreno was given to him by all indications by the great Austrian sages Rav Meir ben Baruch Halevi and Rav Sholem of Neustadt. The Maharil's leadership was tested only a short time after the terrible massacre of Austrian Jewry. As we explained previously, the Catholic Church had to contend with the heresy of the followers of John Huss. It broke out in open warfare. From all over Germany, the Catholic forces of the Holy Roman Emperor Sigismund gathered to wage war against the heretics in their stronghold of Prague. These crusaders promised to wipe out the Jews from the face of the earth after their anticipated victory over the Hussites. Letters of lamentation over the impending disaster were sent from all over the Holy Roman Empire to the Maharil. He immediately ordered a general assembly and fast for all of the German congregations. For 4 days between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, from September 8th to 11th in 1421, and for 3 successive days after Sukkot of that year, the Jews fasted and prayed. At the end, the Catholic anti-Hussian forces which assembled their Satz in Bohemia were struck with such terror at the Hussian army's approach that they miraculously fled for their lives and dispersed in all directions. Famished and footsore, some of those same men who vowed to destroy the Jews now pitifully came and begged from them for bread. From that time on, the Maharil, when referring to Austria, the land which formerly was the center of Torah, would call it Eretz HaDomim, the bloody land, as we quote here on paragraph C on page 15. Besides for his great Talmudic scholarship and the impact that he made on his generation through his disciples and responsa that he sent far and wide, by his example and teachings, the Maharil left Ashkenazic Jewry with a special dedication to the preservation of their customs and traditions. The work that began with Rav Avram Klausner of Yitzchak of Turnau reached their fruition with the Maharil. Please follow me as we read through the next section. This is section 6 on page 15. Maharil Segal said that one should never change any local custom or rite. Even traditional tunes should not be replaced with others to which they are not accustomed. He told us a story about himself. That he once was a shliach tzibur. This is taken from the Minhogim of the Maharil, which was written by his Talmud, by his close disciple Zalman of St. Goar. Whereas he was once a shliach tzibur, like a chazan for the commune of Regensburg for the High Holy Days. He chanted all the prayers was the custom of Austria, as that was the local custom. He was disturbed that they were chanting the Haftorah with the tune of the communities of the Rhine Valley. He said that on that occasion, he said the Slicha, which was composed by Rabbi Ephraim of Bun, to be said for the Musaf prayer. He thought there was a mitzvah to say in honor of Ephraim, the composer, who was buried there in Regensburg. The communal leaders told him there was not their custom to recite that particular Slicha, but he did not listen to them. This was based upon his previously mentioned argument. Well, the author is here, as we should honor him. A short time passed, and the daughter of the Rav, the Maharil, died on that Yom Kippur. The Rav justified this by saying that his daughter was smitten because he had changed the local custom. And the Maharil, from a response of his, he writes, and she was Maharil, from that time I was of sound mind. I have said that the customs of our holy forefathers is Torah. Rav Zalman of St. Goar, in the introduction to his work, which collated the customs of the Maharil, writes, Nisan is the month which the Torah writes, this month shall be to you the beginning of months, It shall be the first month of the year to you. For this reason, I will start from that month and go on from there to elucidate the customs that pertain to every month of the year. I will also explain the customs which I personally have seen, by which the illustrious, precious and majestic one, the miracle of that generation, our master of Jacob and Moshe Levi, the Mariel, the blessed memory, who is known throughout the gates by his sobriquet, Rabbi Yaakov Molin, conducted himself. I've called him in this work by the name Mahari Segel, as he was from the family of Levites. I've also included in this work the sermons and lectures which I heard directly from him on the holidays, which I made notes in order not to forget, as forgetfulness is common, as increased due to our many sins in our exile. And he goes on, you could read this, he goes on to go and explain, says how he put in writing the many customs that he had personally had viewed, the drushas, and as he only spoke a few times a year publicly, and this to the whole congregation, not to his personal disciples, on Shabbos HaGadol, it was the Shabbos before Passover, the laws of Passover. In the Yomim Neroyim, he would speak on the laws of Rosh Hashanah, right before the Slichas. And the Shabbos Shuvah, he would go through the laws of repentance, the laws of Yom Kippur, and the laws of Sukkah and Lulav. This became general custom, by the way, throughout all of Europe. And he went on also to say that in this work that he also compiled the customs works of other greats, Rav Sholem of Neustadt, he also compiles the Marivale, and you can look at it, he was held, as we see, the Maril in the highest esteem. And we come on page 18, just quotes, it's amazing. It says, all of those who live in the Rhine Valley follow the customs of the Maharil. This is written by Rav Chaim, who's the brother of the Maharal. This is Vikuach Mayim Chaim. Rav Yosef, Rav Yosef Han, who was in the end of the 1500s, the beginning of the 1600s, who was in the Besdin of the Shalom in Frankfurt, writes, how can I have the audacity to differ from the words of the Maharil? And he writes further on, the vast majority of the customs in the land of Germany are based upon the teachings and example of the Maharil. And the Truas Be'er Sheva writes, who can argue with the king, the great Mari Molin of blessed memory, was the most influential teacher of the later authorities of Germany. Just to give you a few examples of his influence, you take it for granted certain things we do when we come from the Maharil. This is taken from the Shulchan Aruch. This is in the laws of referring to Yom Kippur. This is in Siman Sotof Resh Yotes 6:19. The custom is that on the night of Yom Kippur, this is how the Shulchan Aruch has it, the Shliach Tzibur, the cantor says, the Yeshiva Shomayla, and this is before Kol Nidre. It is also the custom, he says Kol Nidre, and afterwards he says Shechiyano without a cup. That's what the Shulchan Aruch writes for Yosef Kara. In the gloss written by the Ramah, he writes, afterwards we recite the Maariv of prayer. Our custom is to say Kol Nidre while it's still day, and the Shliach Tzibur continues on with his chanting until nightfall. So three times, and each time he lifts his voice higher. Source is the Maharil. Continues on, similarly, the Shliach Tzibur recites three times, V'nislach l'chol adas b'nei Yisrael. The congregation responds three times, V'yomer Hashem solachti kidvarecha. The source is Minhogim. This is the Sefer Minhogim from Isaac Turner. A person should not act differently from the custom of the city, even in regard to the chanting or piyutim. This is the Maharil, as we said before. Another very interesting thing here in paragraph C. Our custom is to take a shank bone and an egg to fulfill the requirement of two cooked items for the Seder. This is from a response of the Maharil in 58. This is according to the testimony of the Sefer Aguda. The reasoning is explained in the Sefer Rokeach. The shank bone, Zeroa, is symbolic of the outstretched arm, Zeroa and Etuya. The egg is taken because the Aramaic translation of egg is Beyosa, which also means prayer. That's amazing. This is to remind us that they prayed in order to be saved. In situations similar to this, we apply the rule that the custom of our forefathers is Torah. That's really the source of our custom. And again, just to have an idea of what kind of a person the Maharil was. The Maharil Segel never took personal advantage of the crown of Torah. When they called him to the Torah, they only called him up says, you know, he says, you know, Yamoid. They said, Amoid says, Yaakov ben Moreno Harav or Moshe Alevi. He never let himself be called Moreno Harav. He did allow ever his son to bestow the crown upon him when they blessed the son by name and referred to him as Ben Moreno Harav of Yaakov Alevi. This was also the custom of the other distinguished members of the city when they were in his presence. In other words, they did not call themselves up Moreno. Well, this is, again, this is tremendous humility. After his death in the year 1427, the mantle of leadership of German Jewry fell upon the shoulders of Maharil's greatest disciple, Rav Yaakov Weil. He was known as the Mahariv, Moreno Rav Yaakov Weil. At the same time, Asher was blessed with a person of tremendous stature, Rav Yisrael Isserlein, a great-grandson of Rav Yisrael Krems, the author of the Hagos Ashri, which are glosses to the Rush's rulings, and which are printed together with the Rush in the standard volumes of the Talmud. Rav Yisrael Isserlein was a disciple of his uncle, Rav Aaron Blumlein, and Rav Nosson Igra, the chief rabbi of Bohemia, who, like Rav Aaron Blumlein, was an outstanding disciple of Sholem of Neustadt. Rav Yisrael was also the disciple of a lesser-known Austrian scholar, Rav Ozer. Rav Yisrael Isserlein also was a correspondent with the Maharil, whom he quotes considerably in his works. Both Rav Yaakov Weil and Rav Yisrael Isserlein left a rich literary legacy. Rav Yaakov Weil's responsa, Rav Yisrael Isserlein's work Trumas Hadeshen, as well as his customs and traditions were preserved by his disciple Rav Yosef ben Moshe in his work Leket Yosher, formed the basis of much of Ashkenazic halacha. And of course, I mean, they're built upon the Maharil, but and are frequently quoted by later authorities, especially Rav Moshe Isserlis, the subject of a future lecture. Their legacy, in turn, was continued through their disciples, Rav Yisrael of Bruna, Rav Moshe Mintz, Rav Yehuda Mintz. I would like to briefly give you a glimpse as to their special place in Jewish history. Rav Yaakov Weil was just the Marshal, which was also a subject of a future lecture. Writes of him, Rav Yaakov Weil was the leading figure in the latter halachic authorities, and his waters of wisdom were drunk by all those that came after him. One thing now, just to remember, don't forget Rav Yaakov Weil, is the following. Here on page 20, paragraph B. And he quotes in his Chedusha Dinim of Marie Weil, "Some women have the custom of lighting the candles first and putting their outstretched hands in front of the candles, then making the blessings. Afterwards, they remove their hands from its outstretched position so the blessing should be considered the equivalent of having been made before the performance of the mitzvah. They do not want to make the blessing before the lighting because by making the blessing itself, it would be considered as if they accepted upon themselves the sanctity of Shabbos and they would no longer be able to light." And that's why women close their eyes. This is taken from the Rav Yaakov Weil. It's interesting. Today, the leading Sephardic scholar, in his Neshuvos Yabia Omer, writes, you know, the Avadia Yosef. Yeah. It would seem from the words of the Ma'ariv that the outstretching of the hands in front of the candles, truly, is considered as if the blessing were made prior to the performance of the mitzvah. And the question is, how could this? It seems to be just a legal fiction. I mean, how is it just closing your eyes? I mean, the problem is if you light first, if you say the bracha first, and don't light, it's based on the opinion that the bracha is considered as if you accepted Shabbos. Well, if you accepted Shabbos, how could you light? But then the problem is, how do you avoid the problem by lighting first and just closing your eyes or putting your hands over the... So he explains, because the essential purpose of lighting is to illuminate the house in order to create peace in the house. As long as there's no pleasure from the candles, it's possible to make the blessing. It's still considered beforehand. But again, so next time, remember, see the candles, remember the revile. Rav Yisrael Isserlein, it was described again also in the greatest of terms. The Sefer Ogur, which was written at the end of the 15th century, Yaakov Landau, says the greatest man of his generation of Yisrael was called Isserlein, says, was asked the following question. I mean, they deal with him in the greatest of terms, as you can read yourself. In paragraph C, we know directly from the pious Rav Katz, this is written by the Chidor, the son of the author of the Shara Ephraim, that Rav Yisrael Isserlein had knowledge of practical Kabbalah, and that in time of terrible difficulty, he saved the Jewish people through his wisdom. And it would be in place to tell over a story which I saw regarding Rav Yisrael Isserlein, and perhaps this is the incident to which the author of the Shema Gedolim, Rav Chaim Yosef David Azuloy, is referring. As we stated in a previous lecture, during the mid-15th century, the Franciscan monk, John Capistrano, traveled from city to city, harassing the Jews with the intent of converting them. It is told that when he came to the city of Wiener Neustadt, he boasted he could perform miracles and he would walk through fire to prove his sanctity and the veracity of his faith. To this, the Rav of Neustadt, who was Rav Yisrael Isserlein, announced, quote, if the priest will walk through fire, I will follow him, on condition that the emperor guarantee the Gentiles will not resort to deceit. There's a few deceit. It is said that John Capistrano quickly left town. Despite the presence of the towering figures that we mentioned throughout this lecture, due to constant persecution, Germany and Austria at this time, however, were in the midst of a steep spiritual and material decline. As the sun was setting in Germany, a few flickers of light were beginning to shine in other areas of Europe, especially Poland. That story will be the subject of the next lecture. Okay, now are there any questions? The people, right, the scholars. Right. Yeah, you see, the idea of checking the knives was really a matter of honor, not a really a matter of kashrus. As the Gemara itself said, Eidach Nema Bisurim. So really it was a matter of giving honor. And he felt as these people were just not worthy of. I mean, at least it was no longer binding. And evidently they trusted the Shoftim at least were well enough educated in that particular field, even though they were not perhaps scholars throughout all of Shas, to trust them. So that, yeah, let me explain about the idea, the concept of honor. If somebody walks into the room who knows a little bit more than you, you're required to stand up. You don't have to be the godlador. However, these particular laws that were made for what they call the chochem are referring to people who were experts in the entire Talmud and were experts in all of Halacha. And they felt at that time that they no longer were of that stature. Perhaps, and maybe it would be just a corollary to this, around this time is considered the end of the era of the Rishonim. As Jewish history is divided up into different eras. There's a period of the Shoftim, period of the judges, the Nevi'im, the prophets, the men of the great assembly, the Tanoim, the authors of the Mishnah, Amoroyim, authors of the Talmud, Rabbon and Savaroy, the scholars that immediately follow the authors of the Talmud, the Gaonim, and there was a period of the Rishonim. The period of the Rishonim is considered came to an end around this time, and perhaps it's that they felt that that was the drop in scholarship. And afterwards there, the period of, it's called the Achronim. Unfortunately, they don't have a name for us, but that's, you know. Yeah. Oh, that's a very good question. How do we know? In other words, customs really should only, are binding if they were really created by the scholars of that community, or all of Israel. So how do we know what custom is and what custom isn't? Really, I left you to read, in the preface to this work, you know, which was to the Hagdomah, to the Minhogim Ariel, written by Zalman of Saint Gor, he addresses this, and he says, for that reason, I preserve the customs of the Maharil and the other scholars, because I'm an eyewitness. At least these are customs that were supported by these great people. And in other cases, you really don't necessarily know. You have to consult and do research, you know, to find, you know, what is the source of this custom. You assume, though, that if it was in a place of great, you know, again, it's a halacha custom, you know, not like what you eat. And it was in a place where there were great authorities, you would assume that these were something that was done at their behest, or, you know, through them, or with their approval. About the question of Nusach Ashkenazic Sfarad is at the time of the Vilna Gaon. See, the question is, who do you ask? You know, the obvious thing is, well, a person of the stature of the Vilna Gaon, how could anyone disagree with him? If you speak to a Litvak, he would be wholehearted in approval of what you say. But if you speak to a Chosid, they will say that it's true the Vilna Gaon was truly, truly great. But there are many other great people who felt that they there should be a change to the Nusach Ariz. Nusach Sfard is really the Nusach, or based on the Nusach of the Arizal. And they felt that it was important to make that change to preserve, in other words, Judaism. Hasidus should be really devoted to a whole series or a few years, really. But the Litvaks are, you know, hold like you.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.